Welcome to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening. Melissa Ross is off this week. On the map of Florida, Lake Okeechobee is a brilliant blue eye in the lower third of the peninsula. But this week, it's almost filled with a blue-green algae. Some of it may be toxic. The slime threatens the summer season along the lake and in the waterfront communities to its east and west, where the water from the lake is redirected out into the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico. Now, it's happened before, just 2 years ago, when the algae fouled up waterways and marinas, leading the state legislature to approve spending millions of dollars to build a massive reservoir. But construction could take at least 7 years. The algae in Lake Okeechobee is a reminder of what happens in different parts of the state can affect the environment in other parts of the state, and how the environment affects all of our economy, water, and quality of life here in the Sunshine State. Some cities, in fact, have banned polystyrene, styrofoam containers from their parks. Others want to ban plastic grocery sacks. Some restaurants have stopped using plastic straws in an effort to clean up local waterways. So Florida and its environment is where we start this holiday July 4th week edition of the Florida Roundup, statewide edition. Why is Florida's inland sea, Lake Okeechobee, filled with algae? What can be done about it? What's the effect in other parts of the state? And do you support local efforts to limit plastic bags and straws that could wind up as pollution? 305-995-1800 is our statewide phone number to join our conversation. 305-995-1800. Jill Roberts is with the public radio station WQCS in Fort Pierce. Jenny Stiletovich covers the environment for the Miami Herald. She's with us from our studios in Doral. Jill, let me begin with you. You were on the ground just east of Lake Okeechobee in 2016 with that guacamole green toxic sludge. Compare what we saw 2 years ago with what you're seeing this week.
Well, we're not quite that bad right now. What the Corps has done is they have put a stop to releases to the east right now, the Corps of Engineers, which manages Lake Okeechobee. So the thing of it is, the algae is a freshwater algae. So if we keep the salinity levels up in the Indian River Lagoon here, we could keep that algae from growing here, even if it does come. The problem is with our recent rain runoffs and the fresh water that is coming from Lake Okeechobee, which brings that algae, is it dilutes the salinity and allows that algae to grow. So what they're trying to do right now is stop releases so the tide can come in and out and wash some salinity back into our water. What I was told yesterday is it takes 10 parts per thousand to keep the algae from growing, and that's about where we are right now. Although the lagoon itself should be at about 20 to 25 parts per thousand to be at its normal brackish level.
So dry weather is good news for the Indian River Lagoon because it doesn't have the fresh water coming into it from recent rains.
Yes, yes.
Jenny Stiletovich with the Miami Herald, you also witnessed that 2016 algae bloom. You recently visited the shores of Lake Okeechobee. What causes this algae bloom that we're seeing here now 2 years on after the big bloom in 2016? Same kind of conditions?
It's nutrients that feed the algae bloom. So when you have phosphorus and nitrogen flowing into the lake and piling up, and there's stuff coming in, there's also legacy stuff sitting in the bottom. You get it stirred up by Irma crossed the lake with tropical storm force winds. That stuff sitting there, and then you get a lot of bright sunshine, hot days. You get a bloom started. I talked to communicated with a FIU scientist this week,
Florida International University.
Who said that she's not at all surprised at how big it got. It seemed to me that it just last week when I was up there, it covered about 40% of the lake, within
days.
Oh,
it's more than twice that now.
Right.
It just exploded.
Right. So I thought that would seem unusual. And she said, no, that algae can double in size very, very rapidly. And given the weather and the sunny skies and the heat, she wasn't surprised at all.
Jenny, for those living upstream from Lake Okeechobee, what's the importance of this? What's the importance of the lake and the health of the lake?
I'm sorry, what do you mean for those
who are upstream, who live north of Lake Okeechobee, the majority of the land mass of Florida on the north part of the peninsula or the panhandle, this big blue eye that's a bit of a point of pride for those of us in South Florida. What's the importance of the lake in the overall ecosystem of the peninsula?
Well, I mean, it is the south half of the state that gets slammed, and I would hope that we're all in this together.
Yeah, well, how about it, Florida? 305-995-1800. Maybe you live north of Lake Okeechobee. Maybe it doesn't enter into your local economy or environment, but the water drains one way in Florida, and most of that can wind up certainly in Lake Okeechobee. Jenny Stiletovich with the Miami Herald, Jill Roberts with WQCS, public radio station in Fort Pierce, along with us, 305-995-1800 here on the statewide edition. Jill, describe... the scene in the lake. I mean, what does it look like? What does it smell like?
Oh, well, whenever you are around the algae, it does have a toxin called microcystin, and people have been sickened by it. And it does, you called it guacamole, and I was just looking back at some pictures. I actually haven't been to the lake itself, but I see what it is when it comes here, and guacamole is a very good description of it. When you're around it, a lot of people wear masks, and I didn't have a mask when I was there. And really, when I came back, I smelled it, and I said to people, "Do I smell like this algae?" And they said, "No." So I literally had to go in and clean my nose out. Mm. I think that there is, it gets into your nose, and it smells like something's rotting. And of course, something is.
Yeah, right. And Jenny, what is the danger of this algae? We've mentioned that the possibility of toxins. This specific algae bloom this year in Lake Okeechobee. How toxic is it?
Well, so far, FDEP, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, has been out there and testing it. And I was just before he came on air looking at some of their numbers from July 2nd, so earlier this week, and they had levels of microcystin. So there's some toxic stuff out there, and there are health implications. It's also bad for marine life.
Yeah.
What happens is the algae, even if it's not the toxic stuff, when the algae starts to die, it can, I'm not going to remember my chemistry correctly, but it can, the water can become, it sucks the oxygen out of the water.
Yeah,
and it's just kind of a cascading effect.
Yeah, call that deoxygenation. I'll call it that. It's probably okay. The wrong term, and I'm sure the marine biologists will call us and let us know what the right term is there. But one of the other implications of this is politics and money. That's where the state of Florida, regardless of where you live, where Floridians are involved in this. The algae bloom from 2 years ago led to the state legislature passing a really extraordinary bill that provided for millions of dollars, Jill, for a reservoir to hold polluted water from Lake Okeechobee before it would be spilled out to the east where you are near Fort Pierce, or to the west in the Fort Myers area. But yet it's going to take years and years before this reservoir is built and online. So, I in the community that you live in, how does this ecological disaster affect local politics?
Well, it is definitely something. Now that this is happening and it is such a big election year, it is something that is on the front burner for people here. I've covered this topic for 30 years. And in the beginning, in the late 80s, you could put the stakeholders around a conference table. And now the Corps of Engineers came and held a meeting last week, and there was an overflow crowd of more than 400 people. People get on buses and go to Washington and bring up, for this issue just on its own. And a lot of people are not forgetting, because it is affecting the economics. We just had a kayak business close down recently because people don't want to go in the water sometimes. And they actually held a funeral for the kayak, and it's getting a lot of attention. And it is something that people are writing their politicians about and talking to their politicians about.
305-995-1800, talking about the algae-filled Lake Okeechobee here in July, but also broader environmental issues. Some cities have tried to ban plastic grocery sacks. Some restaurants in St. Petersburg are moving away from plastic straws for fear of them fouling up one of the biggest assets in business and natural assets in Florida, our beaches, keeping beaches clean in the Sunshine State. Your thoughts on these efforts? 305-995-1800. We'll begin in South Florida. Jamie is in Miami on line two. Jamie, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. Quickly, I wanted to know, what is the involvement of the sugar industry in Florida, and if this has any effect on the pollution that we're seeing in Lake Okeechobee? And second part of my comment is that we need to pass laws in the state to get rid of all the plastics and styrofoam, anything that is polluting our ecology here. Thank you very much. I'll take the answer off the air.
Jamie, appreciate that. Jenny Stiletovich, the time-honored question here, who's to blame for this algae, and what is the role of the sugar industry that is mostly south, east and west of Lake Okeechobee?
Right. So the sugar industry used to back pump into the lake. That stopped years ago, but they back pump off the fields into the lake, which, when I refer to the legacy phosphorus from the fertilizers and stuff, that's what I'm talking about. Now most of that pollution comes from the north, and it's not just the ag industry. It's you know, urban runoff, stormwater runoff.
Septic tank leakage, oftentimes, is a lot of those legislators in Central Florida will talk
about,
too.
Right, but I think a lot of people get angry, too, because they feel like the lake is managed for the industry to the south, too, that lake, you know, the water table below the lake, you know, is and irrigation is provided to those fields. So, you could just go round and round.
It's as complex as the hydration is in Florida. The hydrology is in the Sunshine State. Very complex. 305-995-1800. I want to ask you, Jenny, about the actions of legislators and regulators in the state of Florida. The Everglades Restoration Plan, which is, what, more than a half a generation old now, we just got word over the past couple of days, I think, that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is trying to speed up the renovation or the repairs making to the Hoover Dike, which is on the southern rim of Lake Okeechobee, that would have what kind of effect when we're in situations like we find ourselves in today with a big algae bloom?
Right. So I don't know how it affects the algae bloom, but when the dike is repaired, water levels could be held higher, which means that the Corps wouldn't have to do the releases. However, there are environmental consequences to holding the lake higher. On the western edge, there are marshes. There's a whole fishing industry over there that would not be happy about higher lake levels. However, it would certainly stop the releases down the St. Lucie.
Yeah, down the St. Lucie and the Indian River Lagoon there to the east as well. Let's go back to the phones, 305-995-1800, Florida's environment. How about polystyrene containers banned from parks and beaches? What about plastic straws and the ubiquitous plastic grocery sack? There's been some efforts to try to ban or limit those. In Jacksonville today, Lisa is on line one. Lisa, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. You're on the radio.
Well, thank you all for covering this important topic. I'm the St. John's Riverkeeper here in Jacksonville, and we are actually having green algae outbreaks throughout our watershed. We're having significant algae in Blue Cypress Lake and Indian River County all the way up here to Duval County. We were on the river today. So this is not just a South Florida issue. Sadly, many of our rivers are polluted with too much nutrients, leading to these toxic green slime events.
Lisa, is your algae bloom in the St. John's also fueled by phosphorus and runoff, same as Lake Okeechobee?
But yes, exactly. It's from too much fertilizer, urban runoff, wastewater, septic tanks that aren't working. We're actually in the headwaters of the St. John's having a high level of sewage sludge being applied, actually importing sewage from Miami that's going into our watershed. So unfortunately, we need a state comprehensive plan to deal with this, and we do not have that in Florida.
Lisa, you said you were part of the water keepers there in Jacksonville and Duval County. Hold on the line here. We've got another call from Jacksonville. Mark has been patient on line four. Mark, you've got a question about the St. John's River. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a great topic. As the Riverkeeper said, You know, we've in Duval County in the mighty St. John's River have been experiencing more and more algae blooms over the years, more intense algae blooms over the years. And I wonder if how this is going to Orlando is busy as they can building a pipeline to suck out 100 million gallons of water a day for their golf courses down there. And I just, it's not completed, it's not online yet, but I just can't imagine that's going to help with the algae blooms and the, and you know what happens up here, you know, flows down south. So you know, it's just you know, we'll never really get ahead of this problem because it's growth, and what the state of Florida is supposed to increase its population by a factor of 50 by the next 25 years. So, you know, how are we ever going to get ahead of this?
Mark, I hear you. Thanks for your call and your thoughts here. Let me put this back to the water keeper in Duval County, Lisa from Jacksonville, another caller. What can you tell us about this Orlando pipeline project that Mark talked about? Lisa, do you know about this?
Oh, definitely. And Mark is exactly right. It'll only make the problem here downstream even worse. The river flows north, and as you start sucking more fresh water out of our river in the southern portion, it'll actually do damage to our wetlands and submerged grasses. Those are the filters of the river. And if we lose those filters, it'll only lead to more pollution issues as well as more green slime.
Lisa in Jacksonville, water keeper there in North Florida, joining us here on the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. Continuing with your phone calls back to South Florida, Boynton Beach. Ted on line two. Let me get you push the right button there. Ted, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi, and I want to thank all you all for having this conversation on today. I think this is critically important for the state of Florida. And as I've been learning recently, not only the state of Florida, but we're getting blue-green algae outbreaks as far away as Idaho now. I work with a company, I won't say the name, I'm not here to pitch it, I just want to let y'all know that I work with a company that in January, after a year of going back and forth, year and a half of going back and forth, our preliminary protocol was approved by Department of Environmental Protection for our plan to be able to deal with the blue-green algae issue, which, you know, the blue-green algae issue begins with, in, for the most part, with agriculture, whether it be cattle farming, the CAFOs that we have around Lake Okeechobee, or whether it's farms and their runoff. So part of our plan is to be able to treat the runoff creeks with microorganisms that will remediate the primary issues, phosphate and nitrogen, before it ever makes it to Lake Okeechobee. Mm-hmm. And that way we remediate the nutrients that would be causing the outbreaks. And we have a very sophisticated system for doing this, for the application, and the microorganisms we're using are bacteria. And they've all been tested over and over and over in live conditions as well as in lab conditions.
Ted, we appreciate the thoughts. Thanks for putting it out there. Jenny Stiletovich, what about beyond kind of addressing the storage problems, which is what the reservoir legislation does, the Hoover Dike dam repairs address water storage. What about some of this idea that Ted is talking about, which is kind of you know, going after the source of the of the problem?
Yeah, I mean, I know the Everglades Foundation right now is has a $10 million prize to try and come up with a way to deal with the algae. You know, it'd be great to clean up the water coming in. Every little bit helps, yeah. But I think the big problem has always been that legacy stuff that sits at the bottom. I think there's been some, you know, numerous ideas to try and figure out how to clean that up.
We got to leave it there. Jenny Stiletovich covering the environment for the Miami Herald. Jill Roberts with public radio station WQCS in Fort Pierce. Jill, great to have you on the program as well. Thanks for your input.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. It's the statewide edition this hour. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa Ross is off this week. July 1st marked a new fiscal year in the state of Florida and brought with it dozens of new laws. One of those is the target of a lawsuit filed this week by Florida's largest teachers union. The Florida Education Association argues part of the law is unconstitutional because it targets only unions representing public school employees. The law is known as House Bill 7055. You may have heard of it. It's a huge piece of legislation by Florida standards. Part of it requires local teacher unions to have at least 50% of eligible members pay dues. If not, the union could be decertified and lose its right to negotiate salaries, benefits, and working conditions on behalf of teachers and other staff members. This is Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran, the day the bill was signed into law.
It's inconceivable that you'd have a a organized union that wouldn't have the support of 50% of its people. And it's not even fair. It's un-American to say to the other majority of people who don't want to be represented that you must be represented by this organization. And all it does is create that fairness and create that equity. It's very American.
The law goes into effect as some local school districts are working to ask voters this fall for more money earmarked for higher teacher salaries. So this is up next here on the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition. Should teacher unions have at least half of their eligible members pay dues in order to be recognized as a union? Would you pay more in taxes to help pay for higher teacher salaries? And do you send your kids or grandkids or nieces or nephews to a non-union school? Maybe you work at a non-union school. You are invited to join our conversation. 305-995-1800 across the peninsula and panhandle today. 305-995-1800. Diane Phillips joins us now. She is a high school English teacher in Brevard County, the 2011 Brevard County Teacher of the Year, as a matter of fact, and is a named plaintiff in this lawsuit. Diane, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Why did you decide to join the lawsuit?
A friend of mine, a colleague, a fellow English teacher at my high school, is was a local union rep and has moved into the first vice president position.
Diane, pardon the interruption. The phone line is a little scratchy. We're going to call you back on a cleaner line, so just stick with us here. The producer will get there, and we'll return to Diane in just a matter of moments. Jessica Bakeman is also along with us, who covers education for member station WLRN in South Florida. Jessica, what is this lawsuit after?
So the lawsuit targets the specific provision in House Bill 7055 that goes after teachers' unions. And this was a more targeted version of a larger idea that passed the House, but not the Senate, this past legislative session, that would have said virtually all public employee unions would need to have this 50% threshold of dues-paying members in order to continue getting recertified every year and continue having those collective bargaining rights. Now, that bigger bill, like I said, didn't pass the Senate. So then in 7055, you know how the lawmakers like to kind of shove everything together into one bill. They call it a train.
Yep.
And they pass it at the end of session. So that happened with this. And because this is an education bill and there's a law that says bills have to have a single subject, this provision only targets teachers' unions. And so that's one of the arguments that the Florida Education Association is making, is that it's discriminatory because it's only targeting teachers' unions and not other public employee unions.
And what could be the effect of teacher unions if this, the law is in place right now, and if the lawsuit is unsuccessful?
Well, some teachers' unions could be decertified, and then...
What does that mean? That means that they're no longer recognized for collective bargaining?
Exactly. So then the teachers and the other professional staff in those school districts would no longer be represented by those unions, or it could provide an opportunity for sort of alternate unions to come up and challenge for the rights. So it'll definitely be different in every single locality as to what happens. But I think right now, at the same time they're doing the lawsuit, local teachers' unions are also doing everything they can to make sure they're at that 50% and that they stay there.
Brevard teacher Diane Phillips is back with us. We've solved our technical problems, Diane. Thanks for sticking with us here. You are one of the named plaintiffs in this lawsuit against the state. Again, tell us, why did you join this lawsuit?
Well, as a non-union member, I know that probably seems pretty unusual. My motive was that the unions are important, and to be honest, I'm a beneficiary of everything that the unions do on behalf of all teachers, union or non-union members. But I just want to make my voice particularly clear that not being a union member is not the same as being anti-union. There are lots of reasons why someone may not have joined a union, and it's not always ideological. It might be budgetary, and in my case it is. I know I can't be the only one, where, you know, even the modest dues per month would cause me to have to reevaluate my household budget. And the irony when I listened to Mr. Corcoran speak is that it really is ironic that I need the union to speak for me to try to elevate my salary, and it's the salary that is the reason that I can't represent my voice with the others through membership. So, you know, over the past 9 years, my salary has gone up by $1,700 total. That's an average of about $185 a year. By no one's argument is that acceptable or in line with my experience or the cost of living.
So you are not a member of your county teachers union, but yet you're suing, you're a member of this lawsuit that is calling this legislation that requires teacher unions to have at least 50% of eligible members pay dues unconstitutional. So, right, it's going to strike somebody certainly as a bit ironic, as you're one of those who is not paying the dues, but you say it's for economic reasons.
Right. I'm in a fixer-upper home right now where everything that could go wrong could go wrong. It's reminiscent of Tom Hanks' Money Pit house, and I'm just trying to stay afloat. And, you know, and to pull off money for that cause, this is a way that I could contribute and say that this is important to me, even though I'm not in a position at this moment to contribute monetarily.
You know, Tom, the argument that Diane is making is one that we heard legislators make on the floor when they were debating this, specifically Democrats in the Senate, and actually even one Republican in the Senate said that this bill was an attack on working people because there are so many teachers who anecdotally would like to be in their unions but are not able to because they can't afford it. I know that locally, union dues annually are somewhere between $800 and $900 a year. And, you know, starting teachers make $40,000 or around there, and Florida teachers are paid among the least in the nation. So I'm sure that there are more people like Diane that are in that situation.
Let's bring Dave Galloway into our conversation. He is president of the Jackson County Education Association, the teachers union in Jackson County in the Panhandle. He joins us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Dave, thanks for making the trip into the capital city. What does the representation look like for the Jackson County Education Association? Are you safely above the 50% threshold that's articulated in this bill?
We're above the threshold right now. We're at 55%. That number might drop a little bit as retirees and people that move out of Jackson County system, you know, shakes out. But we're okay. But we're not comfortable. This threat first came about in 2011 from Representative Placon somewhere down in Central Florida. And we took that threat very seriously then and worked mightily to get our membership over 50%, and we'll continue to do so because given this bunch of legislators, it might be 60% next session.
What are your dues like in Jackson County for the teachers that want to join and select to join?
Our dues are a little less. I mean, they're $55.75 a month per member, somewhere around $660 per year. That kind of lines up a little bit with our pay schedule as well. Our starting teachers start out at $34,000 a year. And we try to, you know, moderate or keep in line the dues with what people are making. But in Jackson County, which is a very red district in a very red part of the state, our members have come to value their membership in the association because of the successes we have at the bargaining table with the district. And I want to be clear, this is not just primarily a salary issue. Everybody wants to pivot to that. It's also about our working conditions that we negotiate. And our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. And that all ties hand in hand to provide a better education for students.
Dave, when you talk about Jackson County being a red area, you mean politically, obviously conservative,
yes,
Republican. And despite that, you've seen your union membership grow at the Jackson County Education Association. Are your members making the connection between this threshold law now and their votes during election year for Republican representatives in the state legislature to represent their interests?
It's becoming more apparent. I mean, let's be honest. People tend to support the home team, and that's the Republican Party where I'm at. And it's difficult, I think, for people to make the connection that the people that they support, in this case, Republican legislators and governors, aren't reciprocating with proper support in their chosen profession, teaching. So it's been a bit of a climb, but, you know, I think people are finally starting to see that the people they vote for, that the elections really have consequences in our day-to-day work as educators.
Well, it's interesting, too, to think about the motivations of individual union members and whether they're looking for help on the local level, whether they want someone to fight for them at the state level in Tallahassee, or even thinking about those connections with the national umbrella union affiliates. And it is interesting in parts of Florida, like where Dave is and other red counties, where you have people who maybe resent that the national unions were canvassing for Hillary Clinton and spending money for, you know, Hillary Clinton's campaign ahead of the 2016 elections, or that the statewide teachers union, the Florida Education Association, is really one of the only organizations, or the only organization, that consistently challenges the education policy coming out of Tallahassee that's coming, at least for the last two decades, from conservative right. Republicans. But it sounds like in Dave's case, in Dave's school district, what those teachers care most about is having that voice at the local table with the administration there.
305-995-1800 is our statewide phone number, talking about teacher unions and a new law that requires teacher unions to have 50% of their eligible members be dues-paying members. The Florida Education Association has sued over that law, calling it unconstitutional. Let's take a phone call here in Broward County, which I believe Jessica has joined the lawsuit, the Broward County Teachers Union. Is that right?
Yes, the Teachers Union and the president are both named as plaintiffs.
Miriam is in Sunrise. Go ahead, Miriam. You're on the radio.
Hi. I used to be a teacher in Broward County Schools. Fresh out of college, and what I began to realize early in my career, because I taught for a very short time, for about 3 years, and what I realized early on was that the unions were not addressing the one concern that most new teachers had, which was, yes, they're helpful in getting your credentials and helping you get certified and giving you the training that you needed, but they did not argue or help, you know, to promote the idea that if one teacher is working very long, hard hours to meet those expectations, and even above and beyond, that they're being paid the same as a teacher, for example, who does the bare minimum. And I think I felt that the unions weren't working in that and to that goal.
That's a good point. The statewide union has consistently fought against merit pay proposals, although the legislature has continued to go forward with those, including the best and brightest bonuses.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. More of your phone calls at 305-995-1800. Jacksonville up next in North Florida. Tim, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I think this union bill is just another attack on education and the shift to move public education to a for-profit industry. What's happening is when you have you're going to lose 50%, or if you get below that 50% threshold, a lot of teachers are going to want to leave, and that's going to create a teacher shortage. And with adaptive learning software that's being produced by textbook companies, that's going to allow them to fill that void by creating more and more charter schools. And you're not going to need any teachers, because what's going to happen is they're just going to pay someone, you know, $15 an hour to sit in front of class and tell their, you know, tell the students to shut up and do their work on the computer.
Hopefully not that phrase exactly, Tim. We appreciate that. But how about that idea, Jessica?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can make the argument that if one of the several differences between traditional public schools and charter schools, which are funded with public dollars but run privately, is that traditional public schools have unionized workforces and charter schools don't, and then you take steps to weaken unions so that maybe a union in the public schools doesn't exist, then maybe that takes away one reason why a teacher might choose a public school over a charter school.
Dave, how about that? What about the competition for teacher labor from charter schools? Does Jackson County have charter schools?
We do not, mainly because, as the previous caller indicated, charters are strictly a bottom line motive driven business. They're not in the business for education. They're in the business for collecting tax dollars. And we've been fighting this war.
Well, I think some charter school supporters may argue that charter schools and the performance and the kinds of attention, maybe special attention that they get for their their kids or their students rival that they perhaps got on the service side from traditional public schools.
Well, perhaps. But speaking of class size, charter schools can set that, and they do have smaller class sizes,
right.
and that does work to their advantage. But it all comes down to the teacher in front of the kids.
Let me squeeze in one more phone call here, Dave. We're just running up against the clock. I want to let the public hear and listen to them in Delray Beach in South Florida. Paul, you've been patient. Go ahead.
Thank you. A couple of things. One is that I agree that public schools in Florida are definitely underfunded and under attack. But also, nobody puts a gun to anybody's head to become a teacher. Interestingly, in Palm Beach County, the union head makes six figures. Okay, teachers don't make that, but the union president makes a high six-figure salary. Also, administration, as far as who runs the school board superintendent and his staff, high six figures, $300,000 a year. There's all kinds of problems across the board. And just one last point, I find it interesting that the lady who is not a member of the union but joined the lawsuit but can't join union because of income or money, because of her budget, yet they want to come to my pocket and raise taxes to pay more for teachers.
Well, so you're talking there, Paul, appreciate that. In Delray Beach, you're talking specifically about a local referendum in your county that is going to ask voters to increase taxes for the design on teacher salaries. Diane Phillips is that teacher from Brevard County. Diane, I want you just to respond to Paul's criticism that you don't have to be a teacher if you're dissatisfied with pay. Think about changing careers. How would you respond to that?
I've had a lot of friends who've done exactly that, and switched to charter schools as well. And to be honest, anecdotally, of those people I've known, they're happier. Two words that come up in conversations, early conversations with teachers on whatever level that I keep hearing are the words overwhelmed and drowning. And I have a lot of colleagues who care about kids, and that's really, no one went into the profession for wealth. They went into the profession because they love their area or the age group that they're targeting and the difference they can make.
Yeah, Diane,
teachers are having to stay up late and do two jobs.
We're about to come up against our bell for this period, if I can use a classroom metaphor there. Diane, we appreciate it. Diane Phillips, a plaintiff in the lawsuit against the state of Florida for House Bill 7055, now a law. Jessica Bakeman covers education for WLRN. And Dave Galloway has been along with us as well, president of the Jackson. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition this hour. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa Ross is off this week. Thanks again for listening. If you have a painkiller prescription to fill, you may only be able to get 3 days' worth, thanks to a new state law that took effect this week. The law limits new opioid prescriptions to 3 or 7 days and has new rules for doctors prescribing the medicine as well. It comes as Florida and the nation have declared public health emergencies because of the opioid epidemic. The addictions, the deaths, especially those caused by illegal opioids, and the cost to local governments for emergency responses. So how will this new law affect prescription painkillers here in the Sunshine State? If you're taking the medicine, what does it mean for you in addressing your pain? And what could it do to address the bigger opioid epidemic in the state? Danielle Pryor is along with us, healthcare reporter with our sister station in Orlando, WMFE. Danielle, how does this new law change legal opioid rules for Floridians?
Well, thanks for having me, Tom. It makes quite a few changes, actually. Like you said, with certain controlled substances, and those include opioid drugs, if they're used to treat acute pain, which is considered normal pain that is short-term, the maximum prescription you can get is 7 days, and that's with, a special ID and special permission that's noted on the chart. It also is going to require doctors to use the Florida Prescription Drug Monitoring Program every single time they go to prescribe one of these controlled substances, so very time-consuming for them. And any sort of pain management clinic that previously didn't have to register with the Department of Health is going to have to apply for a certificate of exemption. So three major changes
more
to
rules,
laws.
Yeah, more rules, more regulations, tighter time frames for those that are receiving these prescriptions. What's the goal of these changes when it comes to legal opioids?
The goal is just to make it, you know, less accessible, to make these controlled substances, opioids, you know, Schedule II opioids are things like codeine, morphine, oxycodone, fentanyl, methamphetamine. So all of those things to try to kind of get them out of people's households and, you know, cabinets in their bathrooms. Most research shows for acute pain, at least, you only need about a 3-day prescription.
Dave Ehrenberg is along with us as well. He is the Palm Beach County State Attorney. He's with us from his office in Palm Beach County. Dave, you've been on the leading edge of regulation and the engagement of law enforcement in opioids. Do you support this law here in the state of Florida? Dave, are you along with us?
I'm sorry about that, Tom. Yes, I'm here. Okay. Thank you for having me on your show.
No problem. Maybe you're on a conference call with the National District Attorneys Association talking about opioids. We'll talk about that in a moment. But do you support this law, Dave?
I do. And the reason why we need a law like this is because you have a lot of people who get caught up in prescription opiates, and then it leads to heroin. And if you look today with the heroin epidemic we're facing, 80% of the people currently addicted to heroin started with a prescription. And it's something that needed to be addressed at the front end. You know, we are in law enforcement here in the state attorney's office. We deal with it after a tragedy occurs. But you can't solve this problem just by putting a pair of handcuffs on people, although that is a good start. But you also need to get at it at the front end. And what you had were, you had many doctors out there overprescribing this stuff to people who went in for basic surgery or had a workplace injury or a sports injury and left as addicts because they were given 120 oxycodone pills when they should never receive that. Another thing is that most of the doctors who were prescribing this stuff for years were not pain specialists. They were general practitioners and others who really were unaware of the potential damage these drugs could cause because they were sold by the manufacturers and the distributors as safe and non-addictive, when really they were neither.
That gets to the point of some communities and counties filing lawsuits against the opioid manufacturers, certainly. Daniel Pryor, healthcare reporter with WMFE. When you hear a law enforcement agent like Dave Ehrenberg, the Palm Beach County State Attorney, talking about attacking the front end of this epidemic pipeline, other than the time constraints putting on the new prescriptions, is this retroactive? If you have a prescription prior to July 1st, does it now mean that you can only get 3 or 7 days supply?
I think it depends on the type of pain that you have and the condition you're being treated for. So again, this only applies to acute pain. This doesn't apply to things like cancer, terminal conditions, chronic pain, palliative care. So if you have one of those conditions, you know, this won't apply. But I'm assuming that if it's a new kind of acute pain from an injury or a trauma or an illness, after July 1st, yes, every single time you need one of these Schedule II or other types of controlled substances, your doctor will have to go into this database, which will take extra time, and they will also need to make sure that they're only giving you, you know, in most cases, 3 days worth of the prescription.
We are talking about Florida's new opioid prescription law here on the Florida Roundup. You are listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. 305-995-1800. Do you have an opioid prescription? Have you had one in the past? You have no family member that has wrestled with the opioid epidemic? Maybe you have some personal experience you'd like to share. 305-995-1800. Dave Ehrenberg is still with us, the Palm Beach County State Attorney, who has been leading efforts to engage on the opioid epidemic. Dave, as the time constraints that this new law puts into place for opioid prescriptions, doesn't that run the risk? Could it run the risk of pushing those opioid users from prescription to street illegal drugs?
It's always a concern that the pendulum can swing too far. It's never the intent of these laws to take away pills from legitimate patients, but we realize that what happens is you have doctors and pharmacists who are very concerned and maybe misinformed about the law, and they will deprive some patients of their much-needed medication. That's always a concern. But then you have to realize that we're dealing with an epidemic, the opioid epidemic, that costs about 14 lives a day in Florida. And a lot of those lives could be saved if doctors had curtailed the initial prescription. And so you're dealing with a lot of competing interests here. And when we dealt with the pill mill crisis, we knew that when we shut down the pill mills, that would cause the demand side to move over to a cheaper substitute, which is heroin.
Right. It shifted into the illicit, to black market.
That's correct. So now if we're dealing, but, you know, you have to deal with this instead of just dealing with it after the fact, after someone is addicted, after someone's arrested. You have to deal with it also at the beginning, at the front end. And I realize that some people may move over to heroin if they don't get their pills, but you have to balance that against the many lives that will not have to deal with an addiction because they won't get the huge prescription at the front end anymore.
Danielle Pryor, the Florida governor has declared a state of emergency. President Trump declared a national public health care state of emergency in regards to the opioid epidemic. Describe the scope of the opioid crisis here in the state of Florida so many years on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's first look at the country, right? As Dave said before, I think he said 14 or 15 people a day in Florida, but we have 115 people a day in the United States who die after overdosing from opioids. It costs us about $78.5 billion a year in health care to treat, and the loss of productivity and the cost of health care and the criminal justice that are involved in this epidemic. So it's huge, just kind of looking across the country. And then if we look at the most recent figures from the Medical Examiner's Commission drug report, which was from 2016, and we look at Florida, we see between 2015 and 2016 a 22% increase in drug-related deaths, a 35% increase in opioid-related deaths. And if we look at something like heroin, we see a 30% increase in that alone, fentanyl a 97% increase. So this is a huge problem that's affecting a lot of people. And it's not just the people that are kind of intentionally abusing these drugs. If you're prescribed these drugs for a minor procedure, it's very possible to become dependent on them.
Let me squeeze in a quick call here before we run out of time. In Orange Park, Ken is on the radio. Go ahead, Ken. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. I'm kind of nervous about this. Monday, I'm having knee replacement surgery, and my question is, how are they going to handle pain management post-op, you know, with this new law? I'm nervous they're going to send me home with 3 days of pain medicine, and then after that tell me to start taking Tylenol, which, having had a knee surgery replacement already, so I'm just nervous and how they're going to handle that.
Yeah, good question. I mean, I put that to Danielle here, but before that, Ken, what was your experience with your previous knee surgery and prescription pain meds?
Well, they sent me home with Oxycontin and oxycodone. Took the medicine as prescribed. I could not do physical therapy without that medicine.
And how long were you on it? How long did you take that prescription?
I want to say 2 months.
Did you find? Did you have trouble eliminating it?
Zero, none at all. Okay. I'm not a heroin addict, and didn't go looking for it after the fact. In fact, I didn't really like the medicine. I don't see how people get this euphoria stuff from it.
Ken, so. let me to your point there, Danielle. What would you say to Ken, who's nervous about having? Well, he's not nervous about his knee surgery. That's nervous enough, right. But he's nervous about managing the pain afterward on a 3-day prescription.
And it's completely understandable. And I think that, he should be concerned possibly because that, I think, would fall into the category of acute pain, which, again, would fall under a 3-day prescription.
Okay.
So unless he gets a special note to get 7 days, it might be 3.
Real quick time, Dave Ehrenberg with Palm Beach County State Attorney. I want to give you the last word. This goes after the front end of the opioid crisis. When should we look for changes in the epidemic? How many years down the road?
We're already seeing some real progress in Palm Beach County. We've had a 62% decrease in the number of opioid overdose deaths in Palm Beach County in the first 4 months of this year compared to the first 4 months of last year.
And this is prior to this law going into effect.
Correct. And I think the reason is that we've stepped up our enforcement efforts. We have a one-of-its-kind Sober Homes Task Force that's gone after fraud and abuse in the drug treatment and sober homes industries. So we've gone after it from enforcement, but also we have a new thing here in Palm Beach County. We have tried to follow up with those who overdosed. Instead of having them get admitted to the hospital and then sent away only to overdose again, sometimes in the hospital's own parking lot, we actually follow up with them to get them the services and rehabilitation they need.
We got to leave it there. Dave Ehrenberg, Palm Beach County State Attorney, thank you for your time today. Danielle Pryor with WMFE Healthcare Reporter, thanks for your time as well. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening.